All right, everybody, welcome back. I'm Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly High Performance Human podcast. Hey, listen, I'm pretty certain in the last few months you've come to value your health and fitness as much as I have. Personally, for the last few years, I've been slowly adjusting my approach, not just in the way I conduct my own training, but the way in which I coach other people. And it's one where health and human performance has come before race fitness. Now, the two are inextricably linked, but what I've become more aware of is how good performance cannot exist without good health. And the whole coronavirus outbreaks just reinforce this belief. In 2020, we might have had our racing interrupted, or it might have been erased completely, but that's not stopped us, has it? We've carried on. I know for sure that many of you found new ways to stay active, and hopefully, like me, you've started to enjoy the process and discipline of daily exercise, and that have given you new purpose. That's not to say we won't embrace the opportunity to race when we get the chance, but I think when events like COVID-19 challenge our health and enjoyment, we start to realise what is truly important. In future podcasts, I'll be sticking occasionally to the triathlon theme, but more importantly, I'll be looking at this whole subject of the high performance human, and I hope you enjoy the new lens which we're looking through, and it will definitely be my goal and my pleasure to share information which will educate you and enable you to achieve your potential as a human being first, and then an athlete, and help you to create the foundation to be the best version of yourself. Whether that's triathlon, ultra running, cycling, open water swimming, whatever you like. Human first, then athletic performance. Anyway, enough of what's coming up in the future. Let's get back to the present and crack on with today's guest. Well, welcome back, listeners. So today we have, I'm absolutely delighted to have this gentleman on the show. It's been a rough few months for him. I mean, if you think you've had it rough the last few months since the whole coronavirus thing got going, then wait until you hear this guy's story. So first, Paul Regan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Paul's a triathlon coach. You were just reminding me before we started the show there, Paul, that it's actually 15 years since you did your level 3 course at Leeds Beckett with myself and Steve Lumley, one of my grumpy old coach colleagues that's on this week's podcast.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it was very enjoyable. Some great people on the course and fantastically delivered by yourself and Simon. Like we said, Mark was on it as well, wasn't he? Mark Lathwaite,
yeah.
Some great people, yeah.
Yes, well, so 15 years. What have you been doing in the interim, Paul, just to give a bit of context to how we got to 2020?
Yeah, so in terms of the coaching, I carried on with other coaching awards as well. I've coached football, coached a bit of triathlon in the early days. I haven't coached it so much recently because of work and studying commitments. And then just carried on with my studies. So they've been a bit ad hoc over the last few years. But I'm currently at Leeds Beckett doing the Masters in Sports Coaching. So I'm hoping to push on with that in the next sort of two, three years, really, and tie it in with trying to push on with the coaching as well. But I know it's difficult. I'm going to have to do a lot of voluntary stuff initially, as I've always done, which I enjoy. So, you know, that's good.
So that's not your primary occupation, though, is it, coaching? You have a full-time job?
No. So I work for a bank, you know, which is the money earning, really, for me at the moment. And obviously, because of the circumstances around at the moment, then it'll be difficult to change that in the short term, but I'm hoping long term that, you know, as time goes by, that I can then maybe try and earn a bit of money out of the other stuff that I really enjoy, yeah, coaching and the studying and the academia side of things.
Okay, so, and how old are you, Paul, now?
51.
51, okay. Yeah. Now, the reason I'm asking that as we get into this is that, let me tell you why Paul has had it rough over the last few months. As coronavirus was kicking off and, you know, we were getting more and more news about people getting ill, Paul got ill at some point and you ended up in a coma, didn't you, Paul, which we're going to talk about in a minute. You were in a coma for 3 to 4 weeks. So we're going to talk about that whole period from when you first fell ill to today, really, and find out what's happened, you know, what your recovery's been like. The reason I wanted to ask about your age is, of course, right at the beginning, the government were telling us that there were certain categories of people who were in a high risk category. So would you, at that point, when we started to find out more about coronavirus, would you have said you were in a high risk category?
Not anything diagnosed. in terms of, I didn't have anything, I didn't have diabetes, or I didn't have any, I'd recently had my chest x-rayed because of what happened last year with my dad. I'd had a scan on my brain because of what happened to my dad. So I had had tests done, so I didn't have anything particularly wrong with me. However, I was overweight and I'd had a large percentage of body fat. So in terms of fitness, whilst I was generally okay, I probably wasn't as fit as I could have been, but there was nothing underlying which would have suggested that I would get COVID because of that, apart from being overweight. But I wasn't diabetic from that. So
no, well, we can talk about that a bit later on then, about your weight and, you know, probably what you've learned afterwards from speaking to the doctors about risk factors and everything. Yeah. So did you come down with a cold that slowly got worse, or did you just wake up one morning, like we often do, just with the flu and feeling absolutely horrendous?
Yeah, so what happened is, what I would say is, over the last sort of 12 months, maybe longer, I had been getting a lot more cold and stuff. And so I think, and because of everything what had happened and the stress of like last year with mum and dad, I think my immune system had been battered and bruised, really. And then what I then found was I had really, really bad flu at the beginning of the year. And I know people are saying they think they've had it earlier than when we went into lockdown and things. And I don't know whether I did have it then or whether it was just bad flu. But my I got a really bad headache and a cough in the middle of March. And then it went away. And then a week after, I got a bad headache and a cough and it went away. And then the week after that is when it really started getting worse. So on the Tuesday at work, I was fatigued. And I thought, God, I feel really, really fatigued today. Carried on at work really when really I should have isolated, I think. And then on the Thursday, which was the 26th of March, I couldn't get out of my chair properly. I just couldn't, like, literally my thighs were just fatigued that much. And I thought,
At work,
yeah. So I came home and I thought, I'm going to have to ring in tomorrow. But anyway, I got up as usual in the morning before I started at 7 o'clock in Leeds. And as I was driving to work, literally my shirt under my top was just literally wet through. So when I got to work, I went in and just saw my manager and said, I think I need to self-isolate. And she went, yeah, you definitely do. So I came home and that was a Friday. Yeah. And then obviously over that weekend, I gradually got worse. So
Why didn't you go to the hospital before then? Was it sort of one of those cases where you thought, I'm not bad enough to burden the health service?
Yeah, it was. And because it was more fatigue than a breathing thing at the time, I didn't think so much that maybe I just were coming down with flu again, maybe. But obviously when I explained about, because I know one of the questions going into about prior to hospital and stuff, then we'll cover that then. But yeah, that weekend was awful. The weekend from the Friday onward until I went into hospital. Gradually got worse, so...
Right. So what were you experiencing at that point then? You got those sort of really high temperatures and the sweats.
Yes. Yeah. So what then happened was on the Saturday, I tried to eat something and I couldn't eat, you know, I couldn't eat. And then on the Sunday, that's when I started getting really worried because that's when the oxygen levels were dropping. And that's when my chest was getting tighter and I was having difficulty breathing. And I just, you know, mentally, I just felt as though I was degenerating slowly. So 4-9-1-1-1. Eventually through speaking to several different people, by the time Sunday came, I'd got that bad that I just said, look, I need to have some sort of treatment or I need to. So what they did is they gave me antibiotics, which my sister picked up and dropped off. I took the antibiotics and within half an hour I was violently sick. So I then eventually it went into the Monday and then by Monday, I think I'd started getting delirious. I was telling my girlfriend at the time, she was telling me that I was saying I just wanted to die. And that's the delirium setting in then, you see, because obviously I didn't want to die, but that's what I was saying. And then on the Monday night into the Tuesday morning, that's when we're 4-9-9-9 because we're getting worried about it.
So you'd been in touch with 111.
Yes.
Were they trying to talk you out of going to hospital then, do you think it was a question of them wanting to this whole flatten the curve thing? They didn't want a deluge of people going unless it was absolutely necessary.
Yeah. So I found that over a couple of days, I must have spoken to about 10, 15 different people through 111. It was like, right, well, we'll get someone to phone you. And then someone phoned me and they said, right, do this. And then I phoned again and then I'd speak to someone. And eventually I spoke to a GP and we did the antibiotics. So I suppose that part of the process was a bit frustrating because it's hard, unless they actually see you and measure your temperature and your oxygen levels, they don't really know. Because I'm talking on the phone, they don't necessarily think, you know, but because the shortness of breath was short, but not like not being able to breathe, I think, And I think whether it was because on the Monday when I phoned, on the Monday night and the Tuesday morning, I think I probably were delirious then. So when they spoke to me, they must have realised there was something wrong. And obviously when the ambulance came, when they tested me, they said, we need to get you in. Oxygen levels were so low and my temperature was so high that I was in this critical, I was at critical stage then, really.
So, right. So where did they take you first then? Because do you live in Huddersfield?
No, I live in Halifax.
Okay.
Colindale Hospital, Colindale Royal Hospital. So what happened was I initially went into A&E and they took my temperature again, things, and obviously, and then I then had a COVID test at some point. I don't know if it was straight away or whether it was after that, but the COVID test came back and failed. So I had to have a second one. And then I also had a chest x-ray. So chest x-ray showed I had pneumonia and the COVID second test came back as positive.
So that's quite interesting then. They must have thought you had coronavirus, and because the first test didn't show it as positive, they gave you another one.
I'd be interested
to know how many other people had tests that were negative that were actually positive.
Yes, yeah. So I think what they said is they said it wasn't negative, you just said it failed. Okay. I did notice that the first test I had done, they hardly put it up my nose and in my throat. They did put it to the back and I gipped a bit. But the second person who did the test, you really know it because they put it right up my nose and really to the back of my throat, like for a bit longer. So
that's quite interesting to me because there are some self-test kits now, but I would reckon that it would be very difficult to stick a swab that far up your nose yourself, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, because my girlfriend actually, she's been tested as well through work and she was negative. But we've got another couple of tests just because I did a week or two ago start feeling a bit unwell again, a bit similar to how I was at the beginning when I first got it. So we've ordered two tests. Now, it says you need to have it up your nose for 10 seconds and at the back of your throat, past your tonsils for 10 seconds. Now, there's no way you can do that for 10 seconds, I can tell you now, because you just have to keep it back out. It's impossible to keep it in there.
Failing, yeah. So you were in Calderdale. I remember seeing a Facebook post from you where you said they were transferring you to another hospital.
Yes. So what it was is I was in what you call a medical assessment unit, part of the hospital, for a couple of days. And what happened was, and this is the bit where towards the end of this is when I must have started getting a bit delirious, because I know I updated Facebook saying that I was going into the ICU. So it wasn't a different hospital. It was just the intensive care unit. And they told me, well, we're going to put you in a coma, basically, an induced coma, and you'll be on a ventilator. And when we do that, it's literally, have to warn you, it's 50-50. It's not guaranteed you'll come out of that. You know, people have died, so you might want to start letting people know. So obviously that's when somehow I've updated Facebook. I can't remember doing that, but I updated it saying that.
You did. They were quite lengthy as well. I remember thinking, how ill is this guy if he can post this like story of all of these?
But I can't remember doing that. And apparently,
really,
a friend of mine said that I phoned him that just as I were going in. Now he's not like a best friend or anything, but either he phoned me because he'd seen me update, and I said to him, "What were I talking about?" And he said, "You were talking gibberish. I couldn't understand anything you were saying." And then in recovery, after I'd come out of the coma, one of the nurses came in and said to me, "Oh, you were a bloody nightmare, you were." And I went, "How do you mean?" And she went, "You were saying you wanted to die, leave me alone. You were getting out of bed and weeing on the floor and we just couldn't control you." And I can't remember any of that.
Oh, well, let's backtrack a little bit and we'll come to that one then in a minute. Yeah. So they took you down to ICU and they said, "We're going to put you into a coma." So you don't remember that point even?
Not going into it or being put under anything, no.
Okay. So I guess when you go into a coma, it's a bit like when they just give you some anaesthetics for an operation. You just slowly drift off and you're out and that's it then.
Yeah. Well, what the physio comes, who's like the head of pulmonary, respiratory things, he said to me that the drugs they give you to put you in a coma are like the sort of dirtiest drugs they can give you for the body. It literally just paralyzes you. So it's a bit, I think it's more than an anaesthetic because it literally shuts everything down. And what they were saying was when you're in a coma, within 20 seconds of not using some of the muscles around the lungs, they die within 20 seconds. And obviously over time, your bigger muscles and things, if you're in, say, for 3 weeks like I was, you're supposed to, you can lose 40% of your muscle mass. You literally don't have, now obviously I lost about 3 stone while I was under. So when I came out, yeah, I was, but obviously we can talk about that as we go through it.
So what, if anything, do you remember from the cone, or was it just like, has it just been like a long sleep?
No, not at all. So basically, some of the stuff, I think, is it might have been while I was being put under. Some of the stuff was during the coma, and some of the stuff was being brought out of the coma. So I had lucid dreams, several lucid dreams, and the dreams were all about survival. So what I mean by that is, I don't know whether you've seen some of the, I did an update on Facebook with some of the dreams I had, but as an example, one of the dreams was I had a couple of kidnapping dreams. So I got kidnapped. So one of the dreams was I got kidnapped with my son by somebody my dad apparently was then from London, and obviously he's not, was a gangster in London, and he'd crossed some people there. They kidnapped me. One was an actor out of Hollyoaks, and one was a Chinese man who owned a Chinese mafia down London, and they kidnapped us, and they were battering us with metal bars, and they were trying to escape, and I couldn't. So those were the sort of dreams, and they were like real. They felt real. One of the dreams was, I was on a slab in Cambodia on a beach with a row of people waiting to be operated on. And I was like the sixth back, and the one at the front was getting chopped up and having his kidneys pulled out. And I was sort of going, and the line kept going down. I was trying to get up and I couldn't because I was paralyzed on this table. So,
wow.
And I had, there's more. I got kidnapped by Bulgarian mafia and got forced to marry the daughter of that. And when I pulled out, they said they were going to kill me. They were all lined up with guns to decide how to kill me. They passed me on to ISIS or Al-Qaeda, who were then going to cut me up, and they were deciding how to cut me up, and they were trying to get off the bed again, and I couldn't do. And, yeah, so it was just, yeah, I mean, I must have had about 15, 20 dreams like that. So it was...
You've done quite well to remember them, because I have some vivid dreams when I'm asleep sometimes, and then when I wake up in the morning, I can't remember anything.
No, and that's the thing, you see. So these are... They're like as though they've happened. So this is when they're saying that. This is when they talk about you get PTSD from it.
Well, I've just written down dreams, PTSD.
Yes.
And that was going to be a question later on about what sort of post coma care you've had and psychological help. But what about all this where the nurses said that you were you were a nightmare and you were peeing on the floor. I mean, you couldn't, if you were in a state of paralysis, you couldn't actually get up out of bed then.
No, no. So this was before I went in the coma.
Oh, okay. Right.
The medical assessment unit.
Yes.
So, because I was in there 2 days and I can't remember the 2 days. They're the bits that I don't remember. So that being the bit where I was delirious. So, because they give you oxygen at first, so they don't put you straight on a ventilator. So I can't remember being put on oxygen. I just remember being in A&E, having the test done, and then I don't remember much out of that apart from then starting the dreams and the coma.
Okay. And during that time, I mean, you said there that they told you, you said earlier that they told you it was 50-50 when you go into a coma, whether you come out of it or not.
Yeah.
Once they put you into the coma, have they said since whether you were stable, or was there any point where they were actually fearful that you weren't going to make it?
Yeah. So what they did was they gave you a booklet when you came out of every day, and put notes on about what happened that day. So it says like, you know, stable or not stable. So what happened was, I was still critical for several weeks, couple of weeks. And then I got better for a couple of days, but then I got worse again. And I think that's when they were thinking the worst were going to happen, because of the fact that I'd fought it, must have fought it and got a bit better, but then got worse again, worse than I was prior to being put in the coma. And then all of a sudden then I got better. So the notes were saying that oxygen levels were going up, body temperature going down, and then obviously they get to a point when your oxygen levels are high enough where they then bring you out of the coma.
I can remember way back, you know, when my grandparents were alive, that my granddad had a what he called an out of one of those near-death experiences where he says he remembers a voice telling him, you know, it's not your time yet, you need to go back. There was that light at the end of the tunnel, almost as if that's, you're going to the afterlife, but he was sort of sent back, and then he goes, a bit like you see in films where all of a sudden you backtrack at fast forward speed and or fast reverse, and then you sort of wake up and you come back into the normal life. Do you recall having anything like that?
Yep, so, because I didn't know whether this was a dream or not, or whether... So I don't know whether this is before the coma or mid or in the coma or coming out of the coma, but there was one point where I believed it was a dream where my dad's mom was at the end of a line, at the end of the bed. I could see her only, but in my mind I could feel all the family all around her who's passed. And she was at the end, and she was the feisty one of the family, was my dad's mom. Sort of the matriarch, who had, you know, a really strong character. Mm-hmm. And she was saying, "You're not coming yet. You're not coming yet."
Oh.
So, but it wasn't like until this was in the hospital bed, and they were at the end of the hospital bed, and she would just say, "Look, you're not coming now. I'm telling you, you're not coming yet. You know, you need to live. You're not gonna die." And wow. Whether I then got better after that, who knows? Because I don't know when it was in that period. So, but yeah.
Oh goodness me! So, how long were you actually in the coma then, Paul? So
I was put in the coma on the 2nd of April. And I think I was taken out around, I believe it was around the 20, it was somewhere in the 20th, you know, like 23rd, 24th maybe. So it was just over 3 weeks.
So you've lost 3 weeks of your life?
Yes, yes, yes.
What does that feel like? You know, can you change your birth certificate now a little bit?
3 years younger, yeah.
three weeks younger.
It does feel a bit like that, but it just feels like, because of everything what's happened from last year, it seems like I've lost 12 months of my life, if I'm honest. If that's how it feels, this was just like the, you know, straw that brought the camel's back, I think, because of everything we've been through as a family. And it's, but yeah, it was. Although, obviously, when I'd come round, you have a feeling of, you know, sort of, why have I survived? Other people have died. And you do have a bit of an epiphany and thinking that, you know, is this an opportunity to, you know, to do something different or to change? But and I had that for a few weeks. I mean, that's sort of subsided now, so I'm back to some form of normality in terms of how that feels. But people died around us when we came up, and I can remember that again. I don't know if I'm dreaming it or not, but because when you bring you around, you're still in ICU for a week, or maybe sort of 4 or 5 days, and we had people in front of us who were in beds in ICU, and they were there one night, and then the day after they'd gone and they died. So, you know, we were actually around people who were dying. So it was, and that's when it hit home, I think, that wow.
Ooh. So when they brought you out of the coma, was it just like waking up in the morning from a sleep?
No, so this is a game where I thought I was dreaming this. So what happened was, one of my dreams was that I was trying to get out of bed. Well, I say get out of bed, but I thought I was a pirate on a pirate ship. And in front of me, I could see a bag, which was my laptop at the time. I didn't know what it was, but it was my laptop bag. And I thought it was gold. And I was thinking the nurses were trying to steal my gold, and I was a pirate. And I would try to get up, and they were pushing me down, and they were saying, no, you can't get out of bed, Paul, or you can't get up, Paul. And I thought they were trying to kill me. So I was pushing off, and I was getting quite aggressive and telling them to F off and whatever else. And on my notes, it said they tried to take me out of my coma, and they had to put me back under because I were too aggressive and fighting. So I think that was what was happening. I believe I was being brought round, but I was still sort of delirious because obviously I thought I was a pirate and they were trying to steal my gold. And I remember them injecting me with something, and then my dream sort of ended. So it's like, it's very surreal, really, trying to explain. And coming on to the dream side of things as well is, one of my dreams was I was being operated on my throat on a plane going to a foreign country, and it was a foreign doctor. And then from that, I sort of transported in front of an hospital, and I had blood above my head, and I was drowning in blood. And then the blood just disappeared, and all I could see was all my body cut out here with a tube going down there. Well, I believe that's when they were giving me the tracheotomy. It's got to be on it, I think. I don't know. Mm. Maybe when they first put it in, maybe you still can't breathe, or I don't know. Maybe there was a few seconds when I couldn't breathe, and my body's gone into a dream, and about not being able to breathe because of blood. And so, yeah.
My goodness. Yeah. I'm not surprised they talk about PTSD. You've had a lot of trauma, haven't you, in that head of yours while you've not been moving. I mean, it's psychological torture as much as anything. But in terms of the physical changes you noticed immediately on waking up then, you said you'd lost 3 stone.
Yes.
I guess that's some body fat because you've not been eating much. Yes. Do they feed you by a tube then?
Yes. So what they do is... And I put one of these links on Facebook, which were quite interesting to read, that they have to have like a really specialised team looking after you because they have to make sure that your body temperature is fine. So they talk about laying on like a cool bed to keep that down. You have a dietitian who needs to check your in terms of your nutrition, and you've got a tube, going down, or through your nose, sorry, goes through your nose, and that just feeds you what you need. And then you've got your meds and whatever. You've got things everywhere, really. But they can overfeed you as well, which can then cause complications. So it's quite a complicated thing to look after you when you're in the coma and ICU, apparently.
Okay. So you lose some fat mass, but you lose some muscle mass because you've basically just been lying there still.
Yes.
So I remember having a personal training client a few years ago, many years ago, who had cancer, and he was in hospital. And he'd got this tumor on his legs, on his back, so he couldn't really move his legs. And I was shocked at how quickly he lost muscle mass when he couldn't use his legs. So, what were you down to? Pretty much skin and bone when you came round.
Yeah, because I was quite big anyway. That probably benefited me in a way. So I was like 17. I was 17 stone 4 before I went in. And then when I say I lost 3 stone, what happened was after coming out of the coma and then going back into the normal ward eventually. I've then ate for a week and then ate for a week at home before I weighed myself. So they were saying that you probably put another stone back on maybe in that 2 week period of not eating anything. So, but when I weighed myself, I was like 15 stone two. So that was like 2 stone 2 pounds. But they were saying, look, you'll have lost more than that because you've been eating for 2 weeks. So that's where I made the 3 stone from. But yeah, definitely lost me because I used to have like muscly legs and I've still got some muscle there, but they're just not what they were, which is a frustrating, but yeah, it's definitely lost muscle mass. I definitely lost it off my belly where the fat was, because I could see that visually. And the thing now is obviously I've got to try and eat for the recovery side of things, but I still want to lose some weight because I'm still too big. I'm still quite a big body fat percentage. So.
Okay. Also, what about other things that you haven't been able to use? You've not spoken for 3 weeks and you've had a tracheotomy tube in. So does that affect your ability to talk when you come around?
That's right, yeah. So the tracheotomy stays in for like 3 or 4 days. So yeah, you can, and you're trying to talk and it's really frustrating because that's the first time I've ever experienced that. And yeah, you're like, you just can't talk. And the problem is as well is you're trying to explain things to them, but you can't as well because they give you a board to write with and you just can't write either. I said, why can't I write? I want a drink. So I'm having to do sign language and they were saying, you want something to eat? I said, no. Oh, you want something to drink? Yeah. We can't give you up to drink because you're like nil by mouth, whatever way. And all they can do is give you a dab of like cotton bud with a bit of water on and you put it in and they dab your mouth. But I'm dehydrated and I want a drink. And I was just like craving to have like a drink of water and they won't give it you. And yeah, very frustrating. And funnily enough, one of the dreams was after I'd had this operation on my throat, they were saying to me that in the dream that I had that I needed to have 2 tubes, otherwise I wouldn't have a certain function. And I ended up being on a boat somewhere abroad, and the boat had 2 doctors on. One was a specialist in throat operations, and he promised me that he'd be able to operate this. And then when I came out of the coma, I was telling him that I've spoke to a doctor who can operate on me. Do you know what I mean? And they were like saying, no, there's no doctor here called Dr. Harris, because it's what the doctor were called. And it was like, why do I think that? And yeah, I mean, some of the dreams do link into when I woke up, I thought I'd had 2 of my fingers cut off. And I'd been, one of the dreams was someone who I used to work with, husband had come home and I was looking after her disabled child. And then he thought I was like having an affair with her. So he's attacked me and cut 2 of my fingers off and cut me bum. Now, I think that's from having the catheter and the thing up your bum and your coma. Again,
right, so
it's all really mad, isn't it, how it's all related?
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, these are the things you've not heard about. We've heard about people who survive. You see the videos of them getting clapped out of the ward. Yeah. I've not actually listened to anybody tell this story at length and talk about these dreams.
There's been a couple of people who've dreamt that. Similar to that, the dreams were like about fighting to stay alive, which you know, most of mine were. And I think that must be your body fighting it or fighting the virus maybe. And it sort of leads into your... It's very fascinating. It's very fascinating.
So you've been lying in the bed for 3 weeks. You've not moved your legs at all, a great deal.
No.
Once you'd come round, was it before you were actually able to stand up unsupported?
Oh, let me think. Probably about a week and a half before I could like shuffle. But that was with like, like something to hold me up. So let me think. So initially I had one of those that got the wheels at the front.
Zimmer frame.
Yeah, that Zimmer frame, yeah. Because that's what I mean, I forget words as well.
Yes.
We'll come on to that. So I had a Zimmer frame. But initially the first thing to do to you, or what they want you to do, is to get out and sit in a chair and just get like out of bed. So that was the first thing that we did. But couldn't have any strength in my arms to pull me out of bed, no strength in my legs to stand up or do anything, so she got put into this chair and I sat there for a bit, and then you just fatigue straight away. You're literally in the chair 5 minutes and you're asking to go back into bed. That's how it was. And then I don't know, it's just difficult. So I know that I could stand up and walk and shuffle when I came out of hospital on the 5th of May. That's when I first came out, and it's probably a few days before I could sort of shuffle on my own without any support, really. But again, I wouldn't be able to do that for a long period of time. It would be a few shuffles and then I'd have to sit down again, or I'd have to get back into bed. But towards the end, I was more in the chair than I was in bed. I wanted to get out of bed and sit up and that. So I used to eat my food in hospital, sat down rather than being in bed. But yeah, so it's probably 2 weeks before I would say that I would be able to stand unaided, which they were surprised with, because the people I was in with weren't at the same stage as what I was. So whether I'm a quicker recoverer or because of my strong legs I had before I went in, that might have helped. I don't know.
How many people were in the same ward as you, Paul? Because you mentioned there that some people didn't make it.
Yes. So from what I can recall, I can remember seeing like 4 beds in front of me. And there might have been 4 beds here, so there might have been 8 of us maybe. But there may have been more beds than that. I'm not sure. But I had, I just know the ones in front of me never woke up from being there. And again, I don't know if I'm dreaming this or not, but I was seeing nurses coming and talking about people and saying, no, he's requested, do not resuscitate, and, you know, and stuff like that. And a lot of it's a bit surreal. I don't know if they were dreams or whether they were actually real. Real things that happened, but they were, from my recollection, they were big people. They looked overweight.
Were you the youngest then?
At the time, I think I was. No. There was a guy who came onto the recovery ward with me called Seamus. He was 50. But I don't know if there was anyone younger. The other two guys in there, they were both older. One was 66. So we ended up being in a recovery ward with 4 of us. So me, Seamus in front of me, and then two guys came at the side, and one was a retired teacher, but he was big. He was really like big and overweight. And then there was another guy who was just old. He was like 78. One of the guys called Patrick, he was 66, and he was still in delirium quite a long time after being put into the ward with us. So we got moved out and they kept in there, and me and Seamus got moved into a separate room on his own. And then two of the guys came in again. One was about 70 odd, and one was so they were different people, really. Eventually there was a guy next to me who had dementia, who came from a care home, and he never woke up once in 4 days. He was just delirious and just like put out, and he was still on a catheter and all that. So yeah, so it's affecting people differently. I can see why the older population, when they get it, why they don't recover.
Are you forming a survivors club then with the other guys? Will you be keeping in touch with them?
Yeah, I'm still in contact with Seamus, yeah. Because his experience was worse than mine, really, when he was in a coma. Because he had underlying conditions. So I put a link on Facebook about his prowess, but he had like a heart attack, and he had to have like blood transfusions, and he'd had like cancer before that. He'd had chemo for, so and he was diabetic as well. So he, you know what I mean, had a lot going on, and he got to the stage where they were nearly turning him off. But just to put him on a bit longer, and then he came round and survived. So,
And of course, what were your family able to do during all of this time? Because there was, we had lots of stuff about people not being able to go in and visit relatives. So
yeah, no, so they couldn't visit. So they couldn't visit. All they could do was ring and get an update. So
that must have been really tough for them as well.
It was, yeah, because it was literally no, there's no better, there's no better. Like for several days, 2 or 3 weeks, wasn't it? So.
Well, I kept seeing the Facebook posts from people saying, come on, Paul, you know, wake up. I'm just checking in. I mean, it must have taken you several weeks to go through all the messages you got.
Yeah. Well, I attempted to try and I started replying to them all. I thought, there's like 1,000 comments here. There's just no way I can. So obviously just, I said to people, look, I can't go through them all, but I know I've had loads of like private messages as well that I need to reply to. And I replied to sort of about half of them, but again, there's just that many. And people who aren't my friends as well, you know, people who've seen the story. And so it was overall, it was overwhelming, really, the support that I got. Yeah, it became a bit, because I think it was, for some reason, now, I think I was the first one who they'd heard about, but a lot of people had heard that I'd got it and were in a coma, really. Mm. So, yeah, it was.
I'll let you off two of those messages that I sent you, Paul. You don't need to bother replying to those. This podcast will do.
Yeah.
let's go back to the PTSD then. I mean, you've had those dreams. Do they provide you with some sort of mental health or psychological assistance and support after the illness?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, that the physio is the head of like pulmonary resuscitation, or the lead sort of physio and that and sort of runs that. And they want to like have, so we're a bit of a guinea pig for how they deal with post coma COVID recovery. So I've got a physio who comes twice a week, and then I've got occupational health who call me. They look at everything all together. So like the physio, the psychology, the nutrition. I've had a dietitian assigned to me, and also ICU phoned for every week for 2 or 3 weeks having left hospital. So it is, the support is there. And then the psychology side of things, initially occupational health will try and deal with that. But now I've just had a recent referral to IAPT, it's called, which is the official psychology arm of the NHS. So I have an appointment with them on Monday. But I think initially I was always struggling with that at first, because I was panicking and getting anxious, thinking I'm going to get kidnapped again, because it was so real. Mm. But that sort of subsided now. So I think I'm going to be fine. I think I'm going to be fine. And when I used to watch things, like when people put people on being interviewed after coming out of a coma, I used to get quite emotional watching it and thinking, wow, that was me 2 weeks ago. You know, and that got a bit overwhelming, and I got filled up a bit, if you know what I mean. I didn't cry, but I got quite emotional, but that's not so much now. So I think, and then the ICU guy said to me that regarding the PTSD, he said, don't worry. He said, I think that will subside. That's our experience of people who've been in comas before. It does get better. So he said, I'm not so worried about that fear. And he's probably right now, because I'm not really worried about it anymore.
Well, you were in a coma at a time when the rest of the world wasn't really doing very much, Paul. No, you know, we were all stuck inside as well. So you've not missed a lot. I know you're a football fan, and you're a Man United fan, aren't you? So maybe you're hoping that the whole football season would have been cancelled and Liverpool wouldn't win the championship this year.
Yeah, that's right. I was hoping to come out and, yeah, they'd lost all 9 games, yeah, and Man City had won all 9 games and they'd won it again. Imagine that. That'd have happened, yeah. Because I've got a few mates who are Liverpool fans, and I do feel sorry for them, I must admit. They've not had anything, have they, for 30 years now. So, well, they've obviously won Champions League, but not the league, which is that's the bread and butter, isn't it, the league. So, yeah.
Well, as we're chatting now, because obviously this podcast will come out a week or so later, but as we're chatting now, today's the first day of the Premier League season starting up again. So, I guess that's something you can still do, is enjoy the football?
Yeah. So in terms of my sort of concentration levels, and I can't find that I can concentrate for longer. So yeah, watching games will be fine. But yeah, hopefully Man City won't lose tonight.
You were saying that you mentioned the forgetfulness.
Yes.
Earlier on. So what are the symptoms and things that you're still battling with right now?
So in terms of that, so as an example, I went out in the car with my son, to pick something up with him from a place to get something.
Are you able to drive yet?
I can drive now. Yeah.
Right. Did they have to pass you fit to drive?
No. They just left that to us, and yeah, just said, obviously initially they said don't drive unless you're ready to. But yeah, I can drive, not for long distances, but you know, I can drive, and I'm safe to do, because I can walk about now as well. You see.
Have you been up to Barnard Castle just to check your eyesight?
Check my legs work. But funny enough, we'll talk about that as well, about physical sight, because we'll talk about eyesight.
Okay.
That links into a GMAD as well, and it's a really weird one.
Tell us about the forgetfulness then. So
the forgetfulness is, so when we went to this place, it said, right, well, let's go to a place called Savile Park for some fish and chips. And Savile Park's about half a mile away from where we were. And I just said to him at the time, I went, I don't know how to get there. I don't know how to get to Savile Park from here. And it's literally a straight road and it's left, and that's it. I know that now. But at the time I said, look, I can't process where I need to go. Where am I going from here? And he started laughing at me. I said, no, I'm being serious. I don't know where I'm going. And it was a bit like that for a few years. And they're just forgetting words, like words that I should know, people's names who I've known for years. Just, I mean, that is getting better. But that initially there was some issues with forgetting things, forgetting how to get to places, thinking about things and thinking, oh, you know, just stuff that I should know, and words, and yeah.
And concentration?
Concentration struggled with initially, not being able to concentrate for longer periods of time. And I think that linked into the physical side as well, you know, in terms of wanting to lie down and just feeling fatigued. But things are getting better now. I remember most things now. So my concentration and attention and remembering things is a lot better than it was.
It's still getting the fatigue?
Yeah, can do. And this is the thing with it as well. What they've noticed from all of us, because I was talking to the physio about it, is you can have 2 or 3 days when you think you're getting better, and then bang, 2 days fatigued walking upstairs, fatigued getting downstairs, fatigued just walking about, wanting to sit down, wanting to go lie down.
So when you say fatigue, how does that manifest itself? Just like if we've been out for a heavy bike ride and your legs feel tired walking up the stairs, you get that, multiplied.
But all over body, and just, you can wake up in the morning and you feel as though you've been like 10 rounds of Mike Tyson all over your body, or being hit by the bat. The worst thing for me at the moment regarding my legs is I've also got edema. I've had that for 4 weeks now. So if I sit down for long periods, then my legs swell up. But they just swell up in general. I know even if I'm walking on them. So I've taken some diuretic tablets to try and get the water out of my body.
There's been quite a bit of talk about COVID patients and kidney problems. So is the edema related to your kidneys then? And do you know if there's any damage to your kidneys, either short term or long term?
Yeah, so I don't know if there's anything longer term. In terms of short term, I had my bloods done on Friday from taking these tablets, just to make sure that my kidney was working fine, and those blood tests are fine, come back normal, no worries about my kidneys, they're functioning fine. And the other stuff they tested for was fine as well. So yeah, which I'm glad with, really, because my tablets went out on Friday, and then obviously I went and picked them up today, but when I came off them for a couple of days, my kidneys started hurting, sort of like getting pain in my abdomen and my where they are, you know, the back. But that's subsided now, so yeah. But it's frustrating, because I don't know, it's a bit like when I look at my calves and stuff, they're absolutely massive. They're like bigger than my thighs. They go that big with the water retention in them. You just got to lie down and put your feet up. Mm. You know, you don't want to live your life having your feet up on lying down on a couch, you know. So I'm hoping that goes. I'm hoping that goes. That's the main thing that I'm struggling with at the moment, because it does get really sore.
What about your sleep? Is that fitful or is it deep and long?
Deep. I do get to sleep, and initially when I came out, I was able to sleep quite well, because you're that fatigued, you just fall asleep straight away. But because of the pain and things, initially when I came out, then I was on like the stronger version of Cocodamol, which is obviously converts to like morphine, doesn't it, in you when you're, so that can knock you out as well. But I've sort of weaned myself off those. And I was conscious that I'd been on medication for so long. When I first came out, I decided I was going to stop taking all my medication for pain killing and that, because I wouldn't let me do it. But after about a week and a half, I would have seen that much pain that I just started again. I see you guys said, look, you're not beating anybody by not taking your pain medication. He said, if you're in pain, that's what it's there for. So I sort of still take that a bit now, but not as much as I was. But you need it, because when I have my physio that night, if I sit down for like 10 minutes, it's like as well my legs are broken when you get up. It's just, you know, and that's why I get frustrated, because you'll know yourself from periodization. Your expectation is that if you train, you get fitter and healthier and you get better. Don't go backwards. Whereas with this, you get better for 2 days, and then before you know it, you go backwards for 3 days. And that's where the 6 to 12 months recovery phase comes in. Mm. And that's people saying to you, look, don't get frustrated. This is how long it can take for you to stop feeling fatigued. It could well be 6 to 12 months. And I'm thinking, God, I never can feel like this for 12 months. So
it's a difficult one, isn't it? I suppose sometimes you have to look back and think, well, where have I come from? In the last month I was in a coma, and now I'm not in a coma. So, you know, you're up, and you've been chatting with me here now for over an hour, and you're still lucid, and, you know, you're not delirious. So that's an improvement, isn't it?
No, I'm not saying I want to die or anything like that, but just a quick one. So on the eyes thing, one of my dreams was that my sister paid to get my eyes lasered. And again, I was in a hospital, and then I wasn't happy about where I was, and I was trying to get out of bed and I couldn't do. Anyway, they operated on me, but it went wrong. And before I went into hospital, things close up weren't so bad. So I wasn't long-sighted. I was short-sighted, where I needed glasses sometimes at night to drive to see things far away. But when I came out of the coma, I couldn't read my phone close up, and I had to wear glasses to be able to read it. Now, before I went in the coma, I could see things close up. And it was really weird that I had a dream about somebody giving me laser surgery that went wrong for me to, you know, for that. And when I came out, I had that. So I needed glasses for that. So, yeah. But that's improved now as well. So
do you think that was something to do with just the muscles in your eyes, not because they'd not been working? They just got a bit lazy.
Could be, yeah. Maybe that's why I dreamt about it. Maybe, I don't know. And obviously I had the usual thing about that you couldn't taste anything or smell anything when you first came around, which was awful. It was like eating cardboard. Every food tasted like, I mean, it was good because it made me not eat crisps and sweets and chocolates because they didn't taste right. And like cans of Coke and stuff just tasted like battery acid. So unfortunately that went better. And I, again, from a nutritional point of view, I know I need to do better in terms of that, which I am doing now, and I feel a lot better for it. So,
yeah. But no thoughts of doing any formal exercise just yet. It's about getting basic human movement back, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah. Because I was just getting to the stage where I've got a bit more ambition about what goals I've got from a physical perspective. And obviously, I haven't really done many triathlons and stuff like that, but, you know, I was going to try and work on maybe having a, you know, like a blog about like going from a coma to doing an Ironman, if you know what I mean. So, but it's a long way off, is that, I think. Mm. You know, it's a long way off. So it's, I don't know how long it'll be before I can start, you know, training properly for it.
But, well, you're still alive, Paul, and you're still talking. Yeah. So that's a big plus, isn't it? Because there were plenty of people out there that didn't think we'd get to this point. So, you know, you mentioned earlier about managing your expectations.
You know. But I think personality-wise, the problem is I'm one of these where it's like an all-or-nothing personality, and nothing's ever good enough. No matter where I get to or what I do, it's just not good enough. And that's the difficult thing to deal with, really, you know. I want to get better in 3 months, not 6 to 12 months, and I want to do this. But it's just sort of, you know, winding that down and saying, look, well, yeah, it's about recovering now. It's not about training for an Ironman. It's not about doing this. It's about recovering and recovering properly. Because it's people who overtrain, don't they, and get that fatigue, and then they can take 6 to 12 months to fully recover, can't they?
And more if, you know, deep fatigue, deep chronic fatigue can affect you for years.
Yeah, and that's what I'm conscious of. So, but yeah.
Have you been able to go back to work yet?
No, so this week is my 12th week since I first went into hospital, I believe. So Friday the 19th, that'll be exactly 12 weeks since I left. And work, we've got a thing at work where we get paid up to, well, up to 12 weeks. We get paid anyway. We get paid, but in terms of absence, they don't class it as absence when you're off. They just class it as COVID, which is really good from an absence perspective. Because 12 weeks off can potentially put you into stages of absence, you know. But they've accepted that, you know, it's an extraordinary situation. So, but that was out on Friday. So I'm just going to speak to my manager tomorrow about going in, maybe potentially starting next week. But we're working from home, so they'd have to have a laptop available for me to do that. So most people are working from home now where I work.
Let's go right back to the beginning, Paul.
Yeah.
When, you know, the coronavirus started to take hold, I should imagine that there was a lot of us were thinking, well, it won't affect me. You know, I'm not in that high risk category. You know, I don't need to wear a face mask. I'm all right still going to the pub or this and that and the other. And we're still seeing people now that are quite clearly blasé about it. You know, would you have put yourself in that category back then in March?
Pretty much so. Yeah, I did mention that. So I wasn't washing my hands enough when I was at work. I mean, we just started social distancing the week before I got Paula. So there was probably a couple of weeks at work where we weren't doing that. But obviously, it was government-led, wasn't it, really? The 2 metres and all this, like, make your workplace. So I can't really fault them. They just obviously followed the guidelines as they came. And, you know, so it's, but I don't know whether I caught it at work or not. I could have caught it anywhere because, you know, we were just, yeah. Could it be anywhere, but I would put myself in the complacency, yeah, definitely, which I won't do again.
And you said there that when you first got ill, you were carrying on going to work. Is that something you'd rethink in future about? You know, because we're all guilty of that. It's like, right, I don't want to be seen as a weak link here. I'm going to soldier on. But yeah. I think perhaps one thing we've also learnt is that in order to protect other people, when we get a cold, we need to perhaps be sensible and stay at home. But then there's a fine line, isn't it, between, well, is it a sniffle? Is it the flu? You really don't know. And what we've learned is that you can be contagious for a few days before you ever start showing any symptoms.
Yeah, that's right. And the same asymptomatic people can still pass it on, can't they, as well? So, but because of my background is I'm a bit of a workaholic and stuff, and you see, even on the Friday when I went into work, when I was like wet through, the reason I went into work instead of staying at home was because I was due to do 20 hours overtime over the weekend, double time overtime. And that's why I went in, because if I don't go in today, then I can't do my overtime tomorrow. And it was like, so again, it was a bit, yes, really, when the middle of March, when I got a bit of an headache and a cough, I probably should have isolated then. But I can't remember whether at that time, was when they were telling people to self-isolate. I think that didn't happen until maybe a week or two later. When did we lock down? Was it around the
23rd of March?
23rd of March, yeah. So, yeah, that would have been the start of the week when I got much worse then. So if I'm thinking about it, on that Tuesday, the 24th, that's when I should have, like, because I was having symptoms of it really then, and I should have self-isolated then. But what happened from work perspective is, When I was sent home on that Friday, all my team had to self-isolate for 14 days then. People I'd worked with, all my team got sent home.
Did any of them come down with it subsequently?
I don't think so, no. So we've had a few people ringing in, before I was off. They had a few people having to isolate for 7 days because they thought they had it. And then there were a few ringing in saying, my partner's got it. So there was people off before me, but again, they're just bringing up to say they think they've got it or someone's got it, whether they did not, because they got 2 weeks off fully paid, didn't they? So you just never know, do you, with stuff like that?
So, I mean, there's been an awful lot of, you probably missed, well, you'd have missed some of it. You might have seen the end of it. You know, every Thursday night at 8 o'clock, we had a minute's clapping for the NHS. I guess you'd be a cheerleader for that now, would you?
I certainly would, yeah. So in terms of that, I mean, they were absolutely fantastic, really. You know, I can't fault them for anything either. You know, when I first went in, and obviously I can't remember much about the coma, but obviously they kept me alive and, you know, being told what's happened while I was in there, obviously I'm very grateful. And then when I came out, when I was in ICU recovering, when I was awake, and then the week I had in the normal ward, the coronavirus ward, they were fantastic. They really were. Always helpful, always smiling, just, yeah, just brilliant, really. I can't speak highly enough of them.
Must have been very difficult because they've got you, but they've got all of those other people, all at different stages. Some, as you've said, not making it. Yeah. Others recovering, but to have to go back in day after day to deal with that, and knowing that you could be risking your own health and that of your family by passing stuff on. It's incredibly challenging situation to be put in, and I would guess that not one of them blinked.
No. And plus, as well as, I mean, I would put myself into not high maintenance, but when I was in hospital, because of like things had to be a certain way, linking into, because I've got quite, not, I won't say severe OCD, but I've got quite OCD. So they'd go out of the room and then you'd buzz them and come back in, and they'd have to glove up and put the stuff on, and then, because they take it all off before they go out of the room. So, and they're doing that constantly all day. Now that can get a bind, I would imagine, wouldn't it? Mm. And then putting gloves on, you know, mask on and stuff, and a see-through like plastic thing there. And then they treat you, whatever, come in. It might only have been like 30 seconds, a minute. And then they go out, take them off in the room, wash their hands and then go out. And then someone might buzz them in the room again, like 2 minutes later, and they're coming in doing the same again. It might be 30 seconds later, and they're just literally in and out all day. So they're on the feet all day. They're, you know, and they never snap at you, or they never say, oh, what do you want now? And, you know, they're really, really good. And some of them might be doing 12-hour shifts doing that, and night shifts. And, yeah. But I've had quite a few messages of people say, oh, you don't know me, but my mum looked after you in ICU, or my mum looked after you in thing and that. And I'd say, oh, yeah, tell her thank you and stuff.
We touched on the fact that while you were in the coma, your family couldn't come to the hospital and they could only get a daily update via a phone call. We've talked about your potential PTSD from all of the dreams you've had and the other stuff surrounding your hospital time. What about the long or the medium-term trauma for your family? Have any of them had any sort of PTSD as a result of just the situation you were in?
Yeah, I'm not sure, really. They've not mentioned that, but I know that, you know, the sisters were very upset. And I think my youngest son and all my sons were all sort of affected by it, especially my youngest one, who's been helping me, like, with my house that I'm doing up, you know, my mum and dad's house. And I think it sort of adds on to like what was mentioned about the year before when my mum and dad died, like this time last year, didn't they, within 2 weeks of each other. And I think they're still dealing with that as well. And I think both myself and my son have not really had time to grieve from that. And it's like having a third grief with this, you know, for my son and stuff. So some of them might need to, you know, to look to be referred for. I don't know. I know my son was recently saying that he was struggling to have motivation to do stuff. And I just think it's the culmination of the last 12 months for him. You know, he's lost his grandparents, and then now he had a fear of losing me, and, you know, it must have been awful for him, really. So I think it's a two-tiered thing. I think it's dealing with the grief from the loss last year, and then dealing with this now. And maybe they've not said anything to me saying they need help or anything like that, but I'm sure there is something there, isn't there? There must be, mustn't there, really? You know?
It will be... Yeah, I mean, kids can be quite resilient, but equally, I suppose you'd want to make sure that there wasn't anything that would start affecting them in the future as well. Mm-hmm. It's just difficult to know whether to broach it with them and raise the subject or let them do it, I suppose.
Yeah. Something I might have to. And I haven't thought about it that way, you know, to be honest. Maybe I need to do it further down the line.
I guess maybe just talking about your experiences will help to bring a lot of it out, you know, just allowing people to ask you questions like, and you've clearly got plenty of answers now, as we've seen and heard in the podcast here. So I appreciate you taking the time to share that for us. I was concerned whether you'd have the energy to get through an hour's conversation, but you've done pretty well, Paul.
Top marks. Work will be seen it and say, no, you can come back to work now, definitely.
Yeah, there's the thing is, it's a bit different, isn't it, having a relaxed conversation for an hour than working on something that requires a great deal of brain power for an hour.
Yeah, and that's what I've got to sort of like take into consideration, I think, when I speak to them, just to, see how it goes. So, I mean, you can have like phased return to work as well, so you don't have to do full time if you want. You can, you know, maybe go back maybe half of the time or something, and because I do three long shifts, you see. I do three 13-hour shifts. So So they are going to be too long. So initially, if I do go back, I'll be splitting up a bit, maybe splitting up over 5 days for a couple of weeks. But in the back of my mind, all I'm thinking is because I wanted to go in and do double time overtime. So again, I'm coming back to wanting to work and earn money. And I think because of last year and because of other things I've been off with, shoulder operations and stuff, I feel as though I've not really worked for ages. And that's, I think that's what's getting to me most. So when I try and get to people say, oh, don't go back too early, it's like, well, mentally, I need to do something. I need to work. I need to feel worth again. So, but yeah.
Well, Paul, that's an amazing story, a horrible experience. I'm sorry you've had to go through that. I feel for you and all the other people that have been through it. You survived, though, so that's a positive. So I'm glad you're still here to tell the story.
Yeah.
And maybe what we should do is check in with you in a year's time and see how you're getting
on. That'd be great, yeah. That'd be great. It'd be good to compare them where I'm at and what stages I'm at. But, yeah, it'll be good, that.
Did you say you've been writing a blog about all of this?
Sort of, because I was going to do a blog because quite a few people have asked me to write down what all the dreams I had, and obviously I've covered some of them with yourself, but there's a lot more as well. So I'm going to put like a dream thing together of everything what happened and try and link it into where stage of the coma I was in. But yeah, I think with the blog thing is I was going to do that more when I'm ready to start maybe taking it to the next level with the training and doing a bit like Thing did before. I remember Tom Williams, who did a blog over a period of time to qualify for Kona.
I do, yeah.
Just me starting, and then people were saying, go for it again. And we're like, well, no, it's gone now.
100 days to Kona.
Yeah, something like that, wasn't it? And I just thought, and people couldn't understand why I wasn't going to go for it again, but his mindset was, I've got that period, I'm going to go for it. I just didn't quite make it, and yeah. So I think I'd like to do some of that, I think, to sort of link it into that. But it'd be good because some people were saying maybe there might be a book in there or something. I'll have to see. I like writing. It's one of my ambitions to write a book or something similar. So I think a blog will be a good start for that.
Well, if you've got anything you need to share, let us know and we'll put a link on the show notes. You've not taken to fundraising for the NHS or anything, have you, since you got out?
Not yet, no. But again, that's something that I'm considering as well to do that as part of the sort of triathlon side of things. But unfortunately, I do need sort of operational money and things that I've talked to you about before. So it's just really, you know, am I going to be able to sustain the training level when I've got like an half knee replacement and an ACL reconstruction? So, yeah.
You can't keep away from the NHS now, can you?
No. And I'm going to need a right shoulder operation and a left shoulder one again. My right's been done twice. My left's been done once. I've got my coccyx to be removed. I've got my lower back thing that's... It never stops working, like, or anything. So it's not debilitating that way. But in terms of... Because my past is I've been really fit and healthy, you know. I was nearly an elite athlete in terms of my football. So, you know, the frustrating thing is, I've got to recognise I'm 51 and I've got these injuries and I might have to reconsider where I'm going to go with these things. So.
Maybe you need to raise money for your own bed in the hospital.
Yeah. I know, yeah. That's what it feels like, yeah. Do a GoFundMe for myself.
Well, listen, Paul Regan, yeah. Once again, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an amazing story to listen to. I hope if it gets me, it's just nothing worse than a nasty cold.
It
doesn't sound like anything anybody would want to experience. That's for sure.
No. I was telling people it was probably the worst experience I've ever had in my life, and I was, how bad it felt was that. And this is a really weird thing to say, but I thought if I got to that stage again, I'd rather die than go through that. That's how bad it was. And I think a lot of people who've gone through it and have the same experience of saying the same thing. So,
All right. Well, we're glad you're still here. And thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Paul. Bye for now.
Bye.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land. So it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.